This is Heroin Addiction, presented by That Time I Got Reincarnated in the Same World as an Anime Podcaster, where we cover romance and drama manhwa, and where flexing your muscles is just a polite way to say hello. I'm Isekai Sensei-sama, aka Brad, and as always, I'm joined by Bento Baggins, aka Ben.
Yeah. Hello.
Be sure to find us on social media, which you can find links for on our website, animepodcasterreincarnation.com. Today, we are covering the perks of being an S-class heroine. So as always, I'll read the summary, and then we'll dive into it. On the outside, Ailette Rodeline is an adorable child prodigy. Cooking, brewing tea, alchemy, you name it, she can do it. But this little girl has a big secret. Ailette is a transmigrator. After dying prematurely in her past life, she becomes a character whose world is destined for destruction. With all odds stacked against her, Ailette must figure out how to survive before her life is ripped from her again. Fortunately for her, she finds her salvation in an insurance package? So, perks of being an S-class heroine. I think I need to kick off this discussion by saying this is the most isekai of all Otome isekai we've read.
Yeah, maybe.
It's got all the hallmarks of like an isekai manga where you have the protagonist reincarnated and given like tons of power. And they use that power, you know?
Yeah. I had a thought and I just lost my train of thought completely. Well, my first thought was when I saw this was like, S-class heroine is really stressing the metaphor of our show a lot. Like that. That sounds like something you should have to pay a lot of money for.
Oh, yeah. And it's not then, cut or anything.
Yeah. And then you get in and it's like, yeah, she's in an S-class world, you know? She's an S-class girl in an S-class world.
Which is interesting. They use it in both directions because it's like S-class as in like the very best. She's got all the perks and super powerful and everything, as you might say of like, you know, guild ranks, you know, F through A, and then S is like the top of the line. Mm. That's the S class adventurer, you know, license or whatever. But then like they also use it in the sense of like difficulty level, because they're talking about this world being an S class difficulty world that she's in.
So, I mean, do we want to start at the beginning, the first things first?
Well, that's the very best place to start.
Yeah. So she's just your average. And as far as I can tell, this is basically the norm in Korea. She's just your average Korean orphan who is abused by an uncle and aunt after her family's inheritance.
It honestly makes me wonder if like anybody has parents in Korea?
Only the evil cousin has parents in Korea.
Which you'd think, like, if all of those evil cousins are the only ones with parents, that they would be less evil, right? Because, like, I guess all of the good people died and left orphans, right?
Yep. Yep.
So Korea,
it's a tough ecosystem.
You can only live until you're like, what, 35 maybe, if you're a good person.
Yep. I saw Train to Busan.
I don't know what that is, but that sounds like a good joke.
It's a horror movie. Yeah, so she's you know, the usual story. Her parents died when she was young. She got taken in by an aunt and uncle who didn't want anything to do with her. They just wanted to squander the money that her family got. And like all of these stories, she's just about to get out. She's got a down payment on an apartment ready. She's got, I don't know if she's going to school or if she's already got a job. I think she's already
in school
or
out or finished school, something like that.
But she's well on her way to finally being independent and getting to live the kind of life she wants. And then in the background of all this, there's a strange epidemic going on. It reminded me of the Jujutsu Kaisen intro where they're like so many thousands of people go missing every year and crime doesn't account for it. Some of these people are cursed. But no, they're actually, it's a transmigration epidemic, and there's an urban legend going around that if you get this text, you're going to die.
And it's like, text. How would anybody outside know that? Like, because the people are dead.
That's the beauty of urban legends. You don't have to ask that question. It's like you know, how you say Bloody Mary in the mirror three times and she comes and scratches your eyes out. Somebody should have their eyes scratched out to have had tried that.
Yeah.
But.
Well, see, I have a friend who has a cousin, and the cousin's friend knows somebody who is acquainted with someone who works with someone who has a friend who got their eyes scratched out. So, confirmed.
Well, then we should probably go in the bathroom with a flashlight and say Bloody Mary three times, see what happens.
I'm not going to. I don't want my eyes scratched out. I just told you it's real.
I don't believe you. So I'm going to risk getting my eyes scratched out to disprove you. So she gets the text. Ever the skeptic. She gets the text. And the text is an advertisement for transmigration insurance. Would you like to buy? And as she's considering that text, she is hit by a, like, 14-wheel semi-truck. This is truck sand on crack.
Yeah.
I was impressed. No
coming back from this one.
Yeah. That is an American-style reincarnation right there. That is a big-ass truck that like, blew her away. And she's got her phone in her hand, and with her dying breath, I guess, she clicks, yes, give me the full pre-ordered DLC package. I want it all, and I want it now. And she gets sent to the, I guess, limbo, the pearly gates or whatever, the place where you wait to see where you go next. And of course, it's a train station. And she's got all of these little spirits going around. I think there's like a floating corgi that's harassing her. And they're like, okay, pick your world. And, you know, she like does a roulette or whatever. And she's like, I want to be reincarnated into a child care novel. And I was like, for the first time, I'm like, my God, these really are the genres. Like,
yeah.
It's all new to me. But I was like, now that I think about it, the childcare fantasy. And it's not like when you hear childcare fantasy and you're not into manhwa, you might think like the fantasy of caring for children. And that's kind of it. But it's mostly the fantasy of being cared for as a child, which is the saddest thing of all. There aren't, so that lends to our theory that nobody in Korea has parents because there is enough of a market for child care fantasy. I want to imagine what it must have been like to be loved as a child.
Here's the thing though, because I have, you know, loving parents who are still married, although they probably shouldn't be. And like child care manhwa is like my favorite genre. So like, I don't know.
It is relaxing. It's nice to see children not be abused, I guess. That's the only thing I could think is it is a relaxing genre, especially, I don't know, especially in this medieval fantasy setting where like every fairy tale starts with somebody being orphaned.
Yeah, that's true.
And you can't get around that. You still need to pay the price, but isekai gives you a way to pay the price and then go to another world where you didn't.
Yeah, right.
So that's the genre. So right,
and it's interesting because even though she gets a terrible pull because that's not the genre novel that she gets to go into, she does get to start in a tutorial period, which is before the start of the novel. And within that tutorial period, even though she's in this terrible world, this S-class difficulty world, because she's in the tutorial period, it gets bumped down to, what was it, E or F? Whatever the lowest difficulty class is.
Yeah. For the tutorial, it gets bumped down to F.
And in that period, she gets to have a loving family. Now, granted, she's missing her mother, and we'll get to that. But, you know, her dad and her brother are great. I mean, they're probably the nicest people in this world. And that's actually not saying very much because there's a bunch of nice people.
So she gets this assignment and everybody's like, oh wow, that's a tough assignment. Wow, you're gonna be back at this train station.
You need to be clear though when you say everybody, because this is important.
The corgi and the ghosts, at this point it's just the corgi and the ghosts. I'm still in the train station, but we'll get to the, I'm getting to the meta humor of the comic. Because everybody in this comic, like all of, there's a whole pantheon.
I think pantheon is the right word.
Who are not only aware of this genre. So this mixes, and I'm guessing there are probably in Korea mobile games that are like romance games that use these novels as the story. I don't know. This mixes a novel, like, so there is a novel, but it has game mechanics in the world she's in.
The idea I got from it was that it's a novel, but like everybody who's being transmigrated is going into a novel world, but they get game mechanics because that's how the whole like system works. So basically the pantheon that is creating these worlds that have game mechanics for these transmigrators to go into are basing them off of existing novels in the world. It's a little convoluted, but I think it's consistent.
So she winds up in this world, but everybody was relieved that she had purchased the S-class transmigrator insurance, which is very expensive and guarantees her certain privileges in whatever world she goes to. And she doesn't really know what that means, but she gets sent in and will have to learn. The thing that made me laugh right off the bat, probably harder than I should have because this is my first time and I'm just barely starting to understand the significance of this, is when they're describing the benefits of the S-class package to her, they go, oh, you'll even have pink hair.
Right.
And I was like, I have noticed the pink hair. I have heard people speak of the significance of pink hair.
Yeah.
I don't fully understand what it means.
I mean, so I think it could actually mean a couple different things depending on the setting that you're going into. But generally speaking, the pink-haired heroine is like, they got it going on, basically. You know, they get stuff done. They could be described as powerful, although that doesn't quite fit in certain stories, but the idea being like they're bending people to their will as much as that would make sense. There's just like,
that's like the powerful character, I guess.
Yeah, to an extent. Power meaning different things in different situations, but yeah. Mm. It's definitely a trope that you can see in a lot of places.
So she's reborn into this world. She's got pink hair and she's got the S-class transmigrator package, which, as near as I can tell, essentially makes the game pay to win. She has access to the item shop and she can buy, you know, actual items. She can buy power-ups. She can buy powers. She starts with some XP boost because she got the S-class thing. So
always go for the XP boost. Like every single isekai, whenever they pick like accelerated growth, you know, XP boost, whatever that perk is called in that world, you become super powerful so quickly and you just race past everyone else that's got, you know, normal XP gain because, of course, right? That's how XP boost works.
And she's also got an amount of starting in-game currency that she can use at the item shop. And I initially thought I was going to keep track of how much she was spending and see if the math checked out. I didn't do that because I wound up reading like on the computer and then on my phone and then like in different places, but I don't actually think it does check out. Maybe it does.
But I think does they do a lot of, oh, she got this money in the background. And
yeah.
Yeah.
So first thing she encounters, she's getting screamed at by the evil head maid. I know enough to know about that. And the evil head maid has an evil daughter who may or may not stand in for her evil cousin in the real world. and they're trying to assign her kitchen duty. And her very kind father is begging them, no, she's too young. Don't make her do kitchen duty. And eventually she's like, no, I'll do it. I'll do the kitchen duty. And I think she buys like a skill or something for cooking.
Yeah. Which is basically how the whole beginning of her time in this new world goes, is that she gets into some, I would say, small problem and goes, okay, I'm going to get this thing from the item shop to deal with this.
Yeah, it's a lot of the setup and payoff of, here's an evil person abusing the power they have over someone they perceive to be weaker. And I'm going to isekai subvert that by secretly being way more powerful than you and using my power to counter abuse you. And so she goes to the kitchen and she just knocks it out of the park. She's the best kitchen staffer ever. There's like a little comedy moment where she's like, I'm going to take a break. One, two, I'm back at it. And then she's just cooking and cooking and cooking again. And then finally the head chef, who doesn't approve of anyone, real Gordon Ramsay type, is like, try my stew or whatever. And she tastes it and she's like, it's pretty good. Needs a little bit of like paprika or something. And the chef is like, that is exactly what it needed. That was a test and you passed. I want you to be my apprentice. And the evil person comes in and they're like, this isn't how it's supposed to go. And the evil girl has the cushy tea service job. And we're like, I don't like that. So like all the servants are going to take a break. And Aelet is like, oh, let me brew the tea. And sneaky off to the item shop, buys a tea brewing thing, which maybe I've been brewing tea wrong my whole life. That's what all of these isekai romance novels have made me think, is that I do. I'm bougie. I buy loose leaf tea. There's a local shop I go to and I boil it to 212 degrees and I steep for 5 minutes, but it's not that complicated.
Do you preheat the teapot with warm water?
No.
You got to do that because if you don't preheat the teapot, then when you pour the hot water in to do the steeping, the cold teapot makes the water cold too quickly. And so you don't get the right extraction.
Oh, man. That's the deep lore. Because like I was going to say, I've even gone so far as to buy like the pot that is supposed to like slowly absorb. Like I have a pot for green tea and I have a pot for black tea. Mm. And so
you know who James Hoffman is, right?
I don't think I do.
What? He's no. The coffee guy.
Oh, maybe I've seen him like on Wired or the
he has been on Wired. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've seen a whole YouTube channel, but no.
I like coffee a bit. I drink a cup of coffee in the morning. That's about it. But for whatever reason, I started watching James Hoffman, and his level of coffee is like the insane level. Now, he's a professional, so you don't go, "Oh, why would you do that?" Like that's his job. Is to be insane about coffee. The level of precision that he gets into about like, this is how you need to do roasts and here's the machines we use for this. And here's this crazy grinder. It's $4,000, but you really need this because it does the grinding in this specific way. And then, but when you put them in here, make sure you do that. We're going to measure out the grams and I'm pouring the water in and everything's sitting on top of a scale so I can get the exact right amount of everything and all that is the level of precision in tea making that these like nobles get into.
Okay. So this poor evil girl was on my level of tea making. She ignorantly thought you just put the tea in the pot, add the hot water and it makes tea. Aylet knows she knows the deep lore. She's measuring grams. She's using the metric system and she brews this tea that may or may not bring the old tea lady to a full orgasm. She tastes this tea and she's like, "Who did this?" And she looks around and it's Aylet. She's like, "You are my new tea apprentice. Fire that girl. She's a stupid idiot. I can't even make, she can't even make tea with a tea bag. She's a dunce." And the head maid is like, "Spy family gone." And, they're arguing, the chef and the tea lady are arguing over who's going to get Aylet as their apprentice. And they're like, "You can have her from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and then you can get her from like 6 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Which so she actually brings up an important point. Later on in the story, you get to this point where she's going out and adventuring and she's doing all these different like gaining abilities in this, that, and the other thing. But then she's also got jobs that she's doing. And it makes me stop and go like, how does she have time to do anything? Like, she's got 14 jobs at this point.
I have a keen eye for Dragon Ball Z style mischief. And I cannot help but notice time moves differently in the dungeons.
Well, that is true. And I think they point that out.
So I think she's taking,
I guess that would cover a lot of it, where she can go into the dungeon and do a whole bunch of stuff. And then come out and not that much time has passed.
And nobody has noticed that she is actually like 30 years old.
Despite being 12. That's actually a good point because if she's spending, hours and hours in a dungeon every day and it's only 10 minutes in the real world or whatever. Yeah, she should be aging significantly faster. But she doesn't.
Isekai mischief. I don't know. But so I guess I'll yada yada a bit. She winds there, up.
There's a lot to yada yada.
Yeah, she winds up deciding she needs to take action to take control of the plot of the novel. So this novel is about a male protagonist who is reincarnated over and over. He lives his life like 50 times.
I want to say it was like 117 or something.
Oh yeah. No, it's 50 was just a number I threw out to mean a lot of times. And
they do call out very specific ones though. I think 7 was important for something.
Yeah, there were 7. She's on the 17th iteration of this kid's life.
Right, 17. There was something about where no one is going to remember her in this life. And then when she gets to the beginning of the novel, that's his 17th. And that's when she actually
I remember this part. So the deal is, the world state gets reset whenever this kid dies. If he dies before completing his mission, he just goes back to the beginning. She is only part of the 17th iteration. If he dies and goes on to the 18th, he will remember her. But to everybody else, she will not have existed in this world. She doesn't exist in the 18th or the 16th. So essentially, what they're setting up is this has to be the final iteration. She's got to keep this guy alive.
Which is going to screw up the novel.
That is going to screw up the novel. And this is where we get into it. So she's thinking about how am I going to keep this guy alive? What does he need from me? He's a good warrior, but he is kind of viewed by his church as disposable. So they don't hook him up with any good healers. He doesn't have a lot of support. So she wants to be able to heal and support. So she's going to take like a cleric.
I think they call them stigma bearers.
Yes. Which is interesting from a religious standpoint, but I won't get into that. So she goes and she wants to take like the cleric class or whatever.
Paladin. So we touched on dungeons, but there's something important that happens before she gets to, trying to find Teslid.
You're right. I yada yada'd too much.
So
too ambitiously.
During that beginning time when she's like, you know, showing up all of the other maids and everything, she becomes friends with their counts, right?
I do not remember
the noble family where she's living as a servant. She becomes friends with the daughter, Bianca. She becomes very good friends with the daughter. And in this time, I think she remembered the story and remembered that in the story, her character is mentioned, but only in like a passing line where it's mentioned that she died in a dungeon burst at a young age. Because I think her brother, Prince, survived and meets the main character and talks about how his sister died.
Yeah. And we should probably, I think I yada yada'd far too ambitiously, because dungeon bursts are the main, I guess, antagonist of this world. Like, this is the main challenge they have to deal with, is occasionally these dungeons, which are like little pocket dimensions of hell, will burst into our reality and start spewing out monsters.
Yeah.
And you need adventurers to go in, beat the boss of the dungeon, and close it, or like significantly reduce its threat.
Yeah, I think there's two different ways that it goes. it can be neutralized and then it's still there and you can like go in and out of it, but it doesn't like spew monsters out. Or you can completely close it. And I'm not 100% clear on how the difference works, because we see them beat the boss in some cases and it still doesn't close. So
I understood the difference to be you kill the boss no matter what, and then you choose to close or not close. And if you choose to not close, the dungeon still exists. There's still monsters in it, but without that like demon lord, they're weak. And you can kind of use it as like a farming or training ground.
Right. So there's a dungeon burst that occurs at the estate where she's working. And she and Bianca get sucked into it. I think they were the only two.
Yeah, they were in a library looking for a book and they picked the wrong book.
Yeah.
And they got sucked in.
So in the original novel, that happens. And are they both killed?
They're never seen again, I guess.
Yeah. Now, in our timeline, following our transmigrator here, because she's got these S-class perks, she's able to use, I think this is the first time she uses Divine Advent.
Yes.
Which basically is sort of like the power that Gon uses in Hunter Hunter, where he uses his power from the future.
She's using holy power beyond what her body can handle. And so it's like what the original like Super Saiyan was conceived to be, is like she can go into it. It like doubles her strength, her powers and everything, but
it's way more than double.
It's draining some part of her life force at the same time.
So she uses this Divine Advent and is able it's actually pretty cool, because when she's using it, she's able to use omnipotence, I think is the proper pronunciation of that. Omnipotence, which allows her to like do a search for spells that can help her in specific situations.
Her omniscience allows, I'm going to be pedantic. Her omniscience allows her to search for spells because that is all knowing. And her omnipotence allows her to cast them because that is all powerful.
Right. So she finds the spells that she needs and she casts them. It's super powerful. She's basically able to deal with this dungeon very quickly, save herself and Bianca. But when she comes out of Divine Advent, she collapses and is like in a state of coma for like, I think it's 2 days. It might have been 3.
Yeah, it's always 2 days. And that's also where she acquires herself a god. And that's when we start getting these pop-ups like in the game. In the comic of all the divinities who have decided to start this transmigration nonsense in the first place. And they are comically portrayed as like a game development team.
Yeah.
And she is the devotee of the voice that shapes the world. And he is, I guess, the programmer. And I forget all their names. Do you have them written down?
I don't. The one that I remember off the top of my head is the architect of, oh crap, what was it?
Of the tower?
The tower of, there's a specific name for it, because it's like, it's like it's not the Tower of Terror. But it's something to that extent.
It's a bad tower.
Right.
It's an ominous tower. And then there's the critic for balance.
Right.
There's the judge of, you know, good and evil. It's essentially
keeping things secret. Oh God, what was it? Confidentiality.
Yeah, the something of confidentiality. So each one of these is a type of person in the Bato comments. Yeah. That is essentially what it is. Like, all of the gods are like, this is the person who criticizes balance. Like, this is the person, like, this one's going to call her OP all the time and try to, like, interfere in a way that makes her not OP or make fun of her when she has to deal with, like, a game balance. This is the person who's going to be judgmental about all the other characters' morality and doing wrong things.
Although the most like the Bato comments one is, I forget the exact name, but every time that she is close to Bianca, they're like, yep, that's, yeah, that one. Yep.
And so she discovers that she has to, she winds up becoming a follower of this guy who made this game, who is actually a god. And he, like, he's got his first religious follower, and all the other gods are jealous. And she calls them the TM gods, the transmigrator gods. Mm. And she has an assignment that she has to pray to this guy. I think this is when he reveals himself. She has to pray for
it's a quest. 1,000 days.
Yeah,
1,000 days.
She starts praying. She doesn't really know who to pray to. So she just starts kind of like unloading. And I liked this, actually. I thought this was actually a really nice... it was a really nice chapter where she talks about all the stuff that's happened to her and how it made her feel. And she's just kind of like doing a little self-talk, self-therapy. And then the god responds and he's like very sympathetic and he like helps her and guides her. And, it was... You say this is the most isekai comic we've read, but I'm going to say maybe it is, but like, you know, I have this perception of isekai where it's like the trope of unearned power. And while she does purchase most of this and it is a power fantasy, like there are these little moments where she's like, in order to get the holy power, she's got to work on herself. Like the prayer serves a purpose.
Yeah. There is, it's not all immediate power. There is a bunch of immediate power that she gets, but also she does need to train herself and get stronger. So
yeah, to the point where I fell into the novel's trap of I'm arguing with the gods. I'm like the god of like balance or whatever, the critic of balance. I'm like, look. Yes, she's overpowered, but have you read the rest of these? Like, leave her alone. She's working. She's doing stuff.
I stick by this is the most isekai. So, yeah, there's somewhat of a difference in that the majority of isekai are going to give the transmigrator all of the power right away. But there's also enough of them where... they get a lot of power, but they still grow through it. So
I think that's what I like. And I think that's the key to making an isekai work for me. Well, and I think that was like with Faraway Paladin. That was, I wound up liking that one.
Well, and in Faraway Paladin, he doesn't really get any shortcuts.
No, just that he has the best trainers, the best.
Right, his shortcut is he gets to train with like the best of the best.
That's the real life OP. Right, my shortcut is I was born wealthy. Right. in a went first to the world best country. Schools,
yeah. Had the best tutors.
Yeah. I was set up for success from the very beginning.
Got magic bread every day.
Born on third base, hit a home run. But yeah, so she starts working on that. She figures out a scheme to take the dungeon that she defeated. There's some skeletons in there. She winds up turning them into like farm hands,
which they are really into, by the way.
They apparently were like these warriors. I loved this backstory, this little backstory for the skeletons of like there was a king and his warriors and they were on their way back from a really tough battle. And the king was like, you know what? I'm going to try farming. I just want to chill out and farm. And then that's when she comes in and she hands him like a pitchfork. And she's like, you work for me now. And she doesn't know any of this. She can't talk to them. They communicate like pets.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
They have a good relationship though. Later on, she defeats a dragon and collects the dragon bones and takes them to these skeletons and like replaces their failing bones with dragon bones and like makes them more powerful.
Yeah. So these skeletons, and they each have like their own little projects. Like one's digging a well, one's trying to like grow this and that. And she uses them to grow ingredients for potions. And she uses those potions to sort of like set her dad up for success. So her dad has his own tragic backstory. He was expelled from the alchemy tower by a evil professor who stole his research. And that's why he has to work for this terrible person who doesn't pay him very well and makes his daughter work in the kitchens. And his son is like the literal whipping boy. Prince is the isekai protagonist. Like, Jesus Christ. He is an actual whipping boy, meaning you can't, like in medieval times, you can't hit the prince. So you give him a friend who he gets really attached to, ideally, and you beat the friend whenever the prince does wrong so that the prince won't want to see his friend beaten. It didn't work. If you've read anything about royalty, it didn't work. They're all terrible. And this guy hates Prince. He's jealous of him. They're both studying the blade, and this guy has no skill for it. He just beats the shit out of Prince, and Prince can't fight back because it's the prince. It's the royal. His name is Prince, and the guy's it's confusing, but. Eventually she takes care of that for him too.
Yeah.
And she hooks her family up. So she gets her dad's business going again. She gets her brother. She's kind of like molding him into a warrior for herself.
Yeah.
If that's how I read where this is going, she takes the alchemy skill as well. She becomes a skilled alchemist. She starts feeding him all these like potions and stuff to like make him strong and better. And he has some natural talent as well. So that helps. And,
In the original, storyline, he goes off to the academy or whatever and, you know, becomes, I don't know if it was an officer in the military or something like that, where, yeah, he's skilled without her, and that allows him to meet the main protagonist, Teslid, in the future. But in this timeline, she sort of accelerates that and like gives him a head start and like is going to make him even better than he was in that original timeline.
Well, and there's like a butterfly effect thing. And I actually also thought this was kind of smart because like it doesn't all just come out of nowhere. The things she changes start to add up to bigger changes, and you can see the logic in it. So Ailet saves Bianca. In the original, Bianca died. Then Ailet finds out that Bianca's brother is beating the crap out of her brother. And they go up there and they interrupt it. And Bianca is there now to reprimand her brother.
Mm-hmm.
So a royal reprimands the royal and puts a stop to it. And so Prince is actually able to fight back. And so when she starts giving these potions to him and he gets like superior reflexes and stuff, the kid can't even touch him anymore.
Right.
So he doesn't have to hit him to win. He can just frustrate him.
I forget how this happened exactly, but she also like wins over the Countess, Bianca's mother, in some
because,
way.
Because she gets the beauty potion. She gives her a beauty potion. And then she comes to see the alchemist with her daughter. And while she's there, the head maid's daughter is saying about how like the she's gonna marry the countess's son, the future count, I guess, and she's gonna become a noble, and if that dumb countess lady who was a lowborn commoner can marry into royalty, so can I. And Aelit's like, oh, please tell me more and loudly about what that plan of yours was. And so she does. And then, like, of course, the countess
is standing right behind me.
Yeah. Yep.
And they get expelled, right?
They get expelled right away. It's another problem solved through her own cunning.
Jumping ahead a little bit, the count's son does basically become better. He's still a bit of a shit, but like he's not a complete asshole.
Well, he needed punished. Like he was just a spoiled kid.
Yeah. And also, good luck taking over the county because Bianca is aiming for that at this point.
Well, I think their challenge is like they're not a super wealthy county at this point, but they're famed for producing good knights, which they haven't done in a couple generations. So Bianca is this like master businessman crafting all these like policies and stuff. And the son, I think, will eventually become at least a competent knight. In the original novel, he paid his way into it.
Right.
But since she knocked him down a peg, he has become competitive in a healthy way with Prince.
Right.
And that's making him better. And they're going to the knight school together and they're going to learn how to actually be knights instead of just buying a title.
Okay. I think we need to go back to go.
Yeah, forward, we need to go back. That's the time.
Which
skip
is, so we've established she has made all these changes by successfully defeating the dungeon, having no casualties. And then we're going to she's going to meet the protagonist. So she, how did she meet?
So Bianca's grandmother comes and Bianca's grandmother has the power of foresight. And so for her whole life, she has known Bianca was destined to die.
Mm.
And as a result, she loves Bianca, but she has been avoiding bonding with Bianca because she doesn't want to feel that hurt when Bianca dies. And when she visits after the appointed time for Bianca to have died, and Bianca is still alive. And with her power of foresight, she can also notice something strange about Aelit, meaning she can see how long a person has to live. And the number of years Aelit has to live doesn't match with the average lifespan because she's a transmigrator. So she's got like a normal lifespan plus 26.
Mm.
So they get to talking and she realizes that Bianca is upset that her grandmother doesn't seem to like her, but the grandmother is not bad. And so they have this tea party and Bianca listens in while Aelit gets the grandmother to talk about why she's been avoiding Bianca this whole time. And they reconnect and she thanks Aelit for saving her granddaughter and her relationship with her granddaughter. And she gives her the cross necklace, which is important.
Yeah.
And she grants her any favor she wants. And Aelit wants to meet the protagonist, but she can't while she's stuck in the tutorial. But there's one loophole that the voice who shapes the world warns her about, which is if you can create enough plausibility in the story for your character leaving, we have to let it happen. And so that's the favor she asks for. She wants to see the holy cathedral or whatever. And that's where the protagonist is.
Right. So they travel. And what Aelit knows is that prior to the beginning of the novel, there's the dungeon burst that happens at the estate, but there's another dungeon burst that happens at the is it called the Vatican?
And they call it the Vatican.
Yeah,
they
do. Whatever that central religious, you know, place is, which is a different country from where they are, but apparently they have free travel. So there's a dungeon burst that occurs before the story starts where Teslid gets sucked in and he's the only survivor out of like 40 kids that get sucked into this thing, which, because this is like a horrible, horrible novel, that's like a horrific thing that happens, right? All these kids get killed. And we actually find out later, it's even more horrific because one of his not friend's friend, another stigma bearer, is actually like, Teslid, you're the most powerful. You have to survive. And so he does something pretty horrific to make that occur, because the condition for this dungeon that has like a full-on demon lord in it, the demon lord is like, hey, only one of you is going to survive. The last person who is alive gets to leave. So Ailette sort of maneuvers herself so she's there at the time of the dungeon burst. And so she gets sucked in as well as all of these other kids. Because she's there, because she knows what she's doing, she's able to maneuver things around and, you know, basically clear this dungeon with no casualties, which the critic for balance is just like, you're screwing up the entire novel. What are you doing?
And then the voice that shapes the world says something that I have literally heard you say, which is, why do we make these worlds if we just want the novel to play out exactly the way it played out? Exactly. We're putting people in there to change it. So let it ride, man. I was like, wow, she's just really, I mean, I assume it's not Bato in Korea, but I guess the comments are the comments no matter what culture or wherever you're from.
But, no, my main thing with it is always like, you know, dense female lead syndrome, where it's like, you're doing things that, but this is more the protagonist and less the people. And it's like, they go, oh, this stuff isn't going how I expected it to. And it's like, you changed things. Why would things be the same way as in the original story? Like, what are you doing?
Because they underestimate their importance. It's cute.
We need to teach the butterfly effect in school, apparently.
Which, you know, we probably should just focus on getting them how to read.
So yeah, she goes and she basically does a divine advent in this Vatican dungeon burst at the point where Teslid is the only one who's still like functional.
Conscious.
She gave the other two sleeping potions. She was trying to put Teslid to sleep as well so that she could use divine advent without anybody knowing. But Teslid is like, she gave it to them by saying like, oh, here's a healing potion. And then Teslid was like, oh, I gave it to my friend because he was more hurt than me. I'll be fine. And she's like, oh, you... Now you're awake, but I still have to use divine advent, right? So he knows what's going on and no one else does, which is a key point because the Vatican, I guess they have some way to detect large amounts of divine power. And so these divine advents keep happening and they're like, we have to find the saint who's, you know, having this massive power burst, like we have to find her, but they can't find her. Which is, I think, going to be a key thing that comes up because Teslid has this strange power where when he follows,
he has a paladin oath from
basically, D&D. Yeah. So when he follows all of these strict rules, which I forget what the good ones are called, but basically
the virtues and the seven deadly sins.
Right. So when he follows the virtues, he gets more powerful. But when he succumbs to any of the sins, it's a negative to his power. Which means he can't lie to people. He has to be kind at all times. To some extent, he can't even have bad thoughts. But they actually find out that he can sin with Ailette around.
He can express himself completely with Ailette without having a penalty.
It's they're not 100% clear on this, but it's basically like when she is the target of whatever he's doing, he has no penalty, because like he expresses himself negatively to her with other people around, but it still doesn't count. So it's like he has to target her to be able to do that.
I can't imagine what real life events might have inspired this. But in this world, the Vatican likes to abuse boys. And they have these boys who are called stigma bearers. They put a mark on them, or they have a mark, I don't know. And that mark makes them powerful, but also disposable. They seem to have a lot of animosity towards these kids for no reason. They just use them as cannon fodder, even though they're kind of like the best defense the church has. It really, there's some mystery there that is yet to be revealed. And the protagonist, the male protagonist, is such like the best stigma bearer, and he has that holy oath, but the oath seems to be forced on him.
But his is, the other stigma bearers don't have the plus and negative that he gets.
So somebody told him, A, he has this. I don't know if it was forced on him or if he took it willingly. And it certainly seems that he is punished beyond the negative if he's not getting stronger.
Yeah.
That's the vibe I get. And so I wonder if like the oath itself has been corrupted to an extent where like he equates kindness with formality. He equates like duty with doing all this stuff. But at the same time, the church, who would presumably want him to become stronger and stronger, orders him to kill heretics who are just basically innocent people living in a foreign country, often, who do not worship
most of this
particular God. And he'll refuse to kill the heretics and he'll be punished for that, even though you would think killing the heretics would violate his oath. So there seems to be like some difference between the ethics of the church and actual human morality.
Right. But I think,
again, I don't know what could inspire that.
I don't think anyone else besides Ailette knows about his buffs and debuffs. Cause like when he's talking to his friends and stuff, they're like, oh, he's just stuffy. We're not actually friends with him.
I thought the church knew, but maybe they don't. But it definitely doesn't seem like something he wants.
So I think there's, you know, we haven't gotten to this in the story yet. It's only like 50 some chapters at this point. But I think there's going to be a point where they're going to be questioning him about trying to find Ailette, even though they don't know who she is. And he has knowledge of her and her power, and he's going to have to lie. And I think what might happen is they'll set it up that he's like, I'm going to lie about this. I'm going to take the debuff, even though it hurts, but I need to protect her and her anonymity. And then he'll lie and it won't affect him because he's lying about her who he doesn't get a penalty from.
It's a really interesting aspect of the story that has yet to be explored, because you could do a lot from a writing standpoint with something like this. And I don't know how deep they're going to go with it, because there's a lot to say about law versus good. Because when he's nice to Ailette, even though he doesn't know her, he suspects she might be like a demon. He can use the oath to determine if she's good, whatever that means. So, like, he helps her, he gets buff. So he knows she must be on the side of good. But then if she's hiding from the church because she doesn't, if the good person who has an actual God behind them doesn't trust the church, well, what does that mean? So I suspect there's, and they're obviously doing something with that. That is obvious setup for a payoff later. Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing they're going for. I'm interested to keep reading that and see what they do. There's some manga comics where I feel like I don't trust the author to explore something that deep. This isn't really one of those. I only have 50 chapters, so I can't really gauge. Mm-hmm. But so far there's been like a level of like emotional intelligence on display in the way they write a lot of the stuff that I have been quite enjoying. I really like that she trains. It's simple.
Well, so we should take the summary a little bit further, because we don't really get to real training until after the dungeon burst at the Vatican.
Yeah.
So after she uses this divine advent for the second time, she goes into her coma to recover. And during this time, the cross necklace that she was given what's her name? Catla, I believe is her name. The grandmother. Catlia. Cattleya. Anyway, so the cross necklace reacts to all this divine power that's going on and releases something, the previous saint, the spirit of the previous saint, Agnes. And so when Ailette wakes up and gets introduced to this person, she's like, "You can help me train." So she starts this training arc, basically, where the previous saint, who happens to be a very, very harsh drill instructor.
Yeah, and like saint, in a lot of these, you know, you think kind of like a magical girl. Now, Agnes is like straight up like paladin, whip sword, like she fights. And I don't often laugh at visual gags, but it actually got an audible chuckle out of me when she put on the sunglasses and the drill instructor costume and just started going ham.
Yeah. Now she starts training with Agnes, and you know, that's all well and good, but Agnes is a drill instructor and she's just running her ragged. The voice that shapes the world sees how hard this is on Ailette and is like, "I feel really sorry for you. I have a bonus for you," and gives her, I believe it's 30 packs of 100-year ginseng.
Yep.
Which, when Ailette takes one of these packs, gives her basically infinite stamina. I think it's for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And during that time, she can train in that 2 hours as much as 2 weeks would give you of training normally. So even though we have like the whole training arc and it's like, oh, she's got to work for her power, she's still taking a shortcut within that training.
She is, but I guess she's going to be overpowered. Now I guess I'm joining the comments. I get she's going to be overpowered. It's an isekai, whatever. I accepted that, but she has to work for it to some extent. She appreciates the power to some extent. I mean, there are people in this world to whom things come very easily. And I think she's just using these items to become one of those people.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, the male protagonist gets the stigma and the oath and the... So he's got, like, superpowers. She's allowed to have superpowers. I'll fight back against the critic for balance.
So we get a training arc, and she gets powered up even more. Although, I guess I should say, this is more her own power, because she didn't really have fighting power before. She had a lot of skills, like we talked about with like making tea and cooking and all that kind of alchemy. That was the big one for a long time. It was the alchemy. She was running around in the Vatican dungeon burst and was just like out of breath and everything. Like she wasn't physically powerful. So we get this training arc where she becomes physically capable. And that stretches for a time. But then we get another bonus. It's sort of a bonus, sort of a different thing. Because before we had mentioned the architect of the tower. Tower of Agony. I forget what it's called. But we have this other god who keeps talking about things this whole time. But we're not sure what this god is actually doing. Well, we get
He's working on the DLC.
Yeah. So this god is like, it's ready. And she basically gets a dungeon that she can go into at any time from anywhere that she can train in. So there's like 300 floors and each floor has a boss monster that she has to defeat to get to the next floor. And she uses this for, it's like 300 floors or whatever. She uses this as like a training ground to just become like way overpowered. During this time, Prince goes to the academy and he levels up at the academy. And when he comes back to visit, you know, he's like so much stronger and everything, but Ailette has been training all this time. And so they have like a mock battle and she just wrecks him, which is supposed to be like the guidepost that we at the as the readers are seeing of like, this is Prince is at like a very high level for this world. And so she's even farther beyond. Although I think I skipped over something important, because I think before the tower is when she goes to that other dungeon that has been closed, or not closed, but like silent.
Oh, they go back to her hometown.
Right. So,
this is kind of the climax of, season one.
Right. I forget why they wanted to do this in the first place. She's given a quest. The voice of the who shapes the world gives her a quest to visit her hometown. And so she's like, okay, that sounds fun. I don't see, you know, what the reason is for this, but that'll be a nice thing. And so her and her dad and her brother go and visit where they used to live before they came to the county. And they lived in this tiny little, basically a shed, but it's like one or two rooms. And so they go and visit this place, and then they go back to this house where they used to live, which is really run down, but they do some cleanup and stuff, and they can spend the night there. And we get this backstory about Ailette's mom, who has been, we assume she's dead this whole time. But we find out that the night that she disappeared, Prince saw her. She was out front and she was holding some gardening tools, like a rake and a hoe or something like that. And she went off into the night, and Prince like remembers this when they're at their home and tells them about this. And so Ailette's walking around like, we went through the whole town. I'm here at my home. Like, the quest still hasn't been resolved. Like, what's going on? So she pulls up her map. Did we mention she's got a map? An in-game map. Of course she does. I mean, yeah. So she pulls up her map and goes, what else is there left to explore? And then she sees this big empty spot off into a forest somewhere that's sort of near her house, her old house, where they're staying right now. And so she goes, huh, this must be the last place I have to look to finish this quest. So she goes and she finds this lake, and she's like, wait a minute, this lake doesn't look natural. It's like perfectly round, and like the sloping of the sides is like, it looks like a crater. And it's like, oh, this is a dungeon burst. And so she goes into this dungeon. And the dungeon is done. Like, there's no monsters coming out of it. It's just a completed dungeon that wasn't ever closed. And so while she's exploring this dungeon, she's walking through this sort of like desert area where it's like, there's lots of sand blowing. She can't see where she's going. And she trips over something that's buried in the sand, which is where we find Fenrir.
Heath Fenrir.
No, just Fenrir.
Daddy Fenrir.
We met Fenrir earlier because he was a consumer of their potions. Now, they had never met before, but he was mining, and he is a muscle daddy. And so he really needs his good potions to keep his muscles up, right? And he rescued another miner, and all of his potions got broken. And so the other miner who he rescued gave him a muscle potion that he had just bought that day that was from the Rhodolines. And he's like, oh, this is amazing. And that's just sort of like a precursor so us, the readers, can be like, oh, I recognize Fenrir, okay? So, but Ailette hasn't met him. The dad hasn't met him. Prince hasn't met him or anything. So she finds him in this dungeon. And he's alive, but he's just like laying there bemoaning the fact that it's been, 3 months or something like that for him? And he's out of muscle potions and his muscles are sad. So they start working together. We find out that Fenrir is looking for his lost daughter. And it turns out that Ailette looks exactly like her. When Fenrir first sees Ailette, he's like, my daughter, my lost daughter. And then he's like, no, wait a minute. No, you'd be a grown woman by it. She would be a grown woman.
Wait, wasn't my daughter an adult? He's not a bright man. You know, like most muscle guys, his muscles are his main friends,
yeah,
and his main support. So
they work together to explore to the center of this dungeon and figure out what's going on. And when they get there, they find this big arena, and there's tons and tons of monsters that are all stone statues. And right in the middle, there's another stone statue of a woman. And Fenrir immediately recognizes this woman as his lost daughter. But at the same time, Ailette recognizes this woman as her mom. Dun, dun, dun.
Who saw this coming?
Everybody. Everyone. Everybody who read it saw it coming because they telegraphed it, which is fine. It's still a fun time. So we find out that Fenrir is actually Duke Heath Fenrir, who just likes to mine as exercise, apparently.
It's like Robert Downey Jr. swinging that hammer into those tires to get those big Iron Man muscles.
Right. And we get the backstory that his daughter, who he found because her mom was a commoner and got driven out or something like that.
Her mom was like an Otome Isekai protagonist as well.
And so after the mom was gone for a while, he went and found the daughter, Elthia, and brought her into the dukedom, but he treated her coldly, which is, he was originally a cold Duke of the North, but he's not anymore. And so at some point he got tricked by another girl who came and said, oh no, I'm actually your daughter. And Elthia ran away because of all this. And so Elthia went and met Leonard Rodeline, and they fell in love and got married and lived together happily until the night when this dungeon burst occurred. And Elthia was like, I have to deal with this. And so she went off into the night with just a rake and a hoe to stop this dungeon burst all by herself to protect her family. And to some extent, the town that's nearby, but who cares about them, right? In defeating the boss monster, the boss monster was like casting like a stone curse or something as it was defeated. And so she got turned to stone. And this was, you know, however many years ago. And also time passes faster in this dungeon. So it's like, oh no, it's been 40 years in this dungeon or whatever, right? Like, this is so horrible. But Ailette is like, no, wait a minute. If she's been turned to stone, she won't have aged at all. And so what did she have, like a potion or something?
No, I think she has to use her divine advent.
Oh yeah, that's right. Spell. Because she says to her grandfather, she's like, don't tell anybody about what's about to happen. And so she uses divine advent and releases the curse on her mom. And now her mom's back. Yay. Happy family again. Which is like the opposite of what happens in manhwas.
Yeah, I was surprised the mom came back, I'll be honest. And I was surprised the mom didn't suck. I thought that might be like a challenge we had to overcome. But it wasn't. The mom's kind of awesome. She's like, the dad's kind of a softy. He's very like emotional. He's very, like pining for her and everything. And he's just like this bookish nerd. And the mom is like this like intense jock.
Yeah.
And she's like recognizes that Ailette knows how to fight, and she becomes the Countess's bodyguard, and they all get to keep like living there, and it's just great. Everything's awesome.
Okay.
The mom's very supportive and gives her a sword.
Yeah.
It's super cool.
The tower training arc starts after she gets back from this trip. So she's got her mom back. Her brother's doing great. Her dad's doing great. Her life is going just great. And she's training up. And then we get to do a time skip, because we don't need a montage. We need a time skip.
We kind of did need a time skip, because this tutorial has been going on for a while.
Yeah. So we get a bit of a fast forward. She's beating the tower. You know, each level of the tower is taking her longer and longer to complete, but she's doing a great job. She's getting through them. She's getting some nice rewards. She's, you know, getting more powerful and everything. And she finally completes the tower, and she gets a cool sword from one of the like seven dragons in a row that she has to beat, where they're like, come on, architect, this is just lazy. And then once the tower is complete, she also completes her Pray 1,000 times quest line. And so when that happens, she gets upgraded to an actual saint. And when this occurs, the people in the Vatican are like, oh my God, the saint has awakened. We have to find her. We already knew that there was something going on because of these divine advents that we felt. But now we felt this like massive burst of divine power that is like the saint's awakening.
And so, an actual holy person in the world. Why don't they want to talk to us?
So up to the last chapter that I read, we get to right before the start of the main book, if that's what it's, we're calling it, the novel. Which leaves us at a sort of a weird spot, because all of the stuff that's happened up until now has been within this tutorial period where it's not actually the main story that occurs. And so I'm wondering, like, is this going to be, is a lot of stuff going to change? Are we going to get into the main story, the main novel, and like things are going to go really, really bad because it's, you know, S-class difficulty world. And she's been living in an F-class difficulty tutorial this whole time.
I don't think they're going to do like a whole tone shift, but I do think there's going to be some darkness. I think we got to figure out what's going on with the church. They're not cool. I don't know what that is. We haven't met any Imperials or like the main kings. And we got to figure out what's going on with this. I don't know if the church is the one doing all this or what, like, but there's demon lords that are aware of the male protagonist and are out to make him suffer. So they're going to have to come like overcome that. So I think there's some human enemies, some supernatural enemies. I like that it's set up. I got to say, though, I am surprised that, like, they called season one where they did.
Yeah.
Because it feels like chapter 50 was like, okay, that's season one.
Right.
Like, you had to, like, why would you end the season and then come back and have five chapters and end the tutorial?
Right.
I don't know. It's a... I can't speak to their organization. Maybe that's more to do with time crunch or availability than anything.
Maybe.
But no, this is a good one.
So anything else we want to cover before we jump into the rubric?
No, I think the rubric will guide. I think that's the story. I mean, I hope you've read it already, because the summary is probably a lot more meaningful if you're able to fill in the many, many gaps.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think those are the main things we're going to highlight in the rubric.
All right. Well, let's jump into it then. Oh, there's something interesting here, because I've been hearing a lot of talk about, like, oh, the Teslet is the male lead, and like there's going to be this romance between Eilat and Teslet and all this stuff. And like, you can definitely see that that's where they're probably going to go with it, especially considering that Eilat doesn't affect his debuffs. And so he'll be able to express his sinful desires with her without experiencing a debuff.
Yeah, I'm uncomfortable with the messaging on that, but we'll see about.
They're not going to be children anymore. So
no. I mean that him, like, I don't think partnering is sinful. Like, I'm interested in what they do with his oath and what the oath actually means, because that there could be a moral undercurrent where I like disagree. But I don't think that's where they're going.
Yeah. So all that to say, this is not the romance rubric as much as some people are saying, like, oh, there's going to be this great romance in here. It's like, well, we're not there yet. And there's not really any romance. So
it can be the romance rubric. Like, maybe when we come back, like if we come back at like the end of season two, if they ended in a good spot,
it'll probably be more like, you know, season three or four.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Like, I'm sure there will be a romance thing. I see the seeds of it. Like, I like that they have powers that are more effective if they use them on each other. Like, he can protect her better and she can heal him better. And yeah. They're obviously setting that up. They're obviously foreshadowing it. But is it going to be like, is this, I let story... And he is a love interest in it, or is it a love story?
Right.
Right now, it's Ilette's story, and he's just a love interest.
Although not really even at this point. Like, I don't think she really feels much of anything about him besides like, oh, he's the main protagonist, and I want to like help him out. Whereas
he obviously likes her because yeah, like, he thinks about her something. And he caught feels, but like also. How could he not when
she's got that pink hair?
Well, no, I was going to say literally the only person he's ever been able to feel comfortable around.
Right.
Like that's not romance yet. That's just two people who are kind of interested in each other that could become romance. Certainly could. And like you said, will one way or another, but will it be good? I don't know. I can't judge that right now.
So if you're scoring along at home, we're going to be using the non-romance rubric. The romance rubric isn't actually up on the website yet because we haven't used it yet. But if you're listening to this in the future and you want to play along, we're using the non-romance rubric. Something that I have failed to do so far, but I will be doing starting this episode and going back and filling in the previous episodes, is actually putting our scores for the rubric up in the description. That will only be on the website. So if you're listening to this and you look in the description on your podcast app and you don't see that, you got to go to the website. You can leave comments there. So that's where I will be putting the table that has our scores in it. So. All right, so we're going to kick it off with content and ideas. And I'm going to give this what might be a bit of a controversial score here.
Oh, my.
Because I'm going to give this a 3 for content and ideas.
You monster.
Yeah. The reason that I'm giving it a 3... Because even though I think a lot of the plot points are developed fairly well, I think overall this isn't original enough for me to give this a 4. It pulls so much stuff from other isekai and uses so many isekai tropes that it explores... Realistically, I'd give this like a 3.5, but we're not giving half scores here. So because it uses so many of those tropes and it does that, you know, power fantasy stuff so much, I'm going to have to go with a 3.
So I went with a 4, and that could be my lack of consuming as many isekais. Like,
well, I think four is perfectly fair.
It seems, I wouldn't say it's like brimming with originality, but there are a few things I've seen here that I haven't really seen before, which, the meta humor, I mean, I've seen meta humor before in these, but like the gods really kind of take it to the next level and it weaves into the story in a way that's not too intrusive.
Yeah.
And is actually kind of funny. And it's interesting to see the gods like change their relationship. And I also do enjoy the joke of them being office workers. I also really like, and I don't know if they'll keep this up because I haven't seen it in the last, say, 10 or so chapters, but the butterfly effect of, because Bianca's there, the brother changes, which means Prince changes, which means, like, I liked the cascade of changes that seemed really well thought out, really planned out.
Right.
If they can keep that up, that would be something I personally haven't seen before.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of the stuff in there is really good. For anyone who doesn't read 700 different isekai, it's definitely a four. I will give you that. But personally, I can't put it at a four just because of my curse of knowledge.
No, I can see that. I don't think it's like the most original thing I've ever seen, but there was stuff. There's a few ideas I hadn't seen before.
Yeah. So. Well, and you know, just as a reminder, Ben, you usually remind us of this every time, but a three is a good three. Yes. Three's, you know, it's middle of the road, but it's not bad. It's just not great.
Yes.
So pacing and structure.
This is where I went with a three.
Okay.
I think it's moving a little slow towards the whole tutorial thing. I think it would have helped me a lot if they didn't call it the tutorial. There's certain limits put on the story in a way that they spend a lot of time focusing on, it's a tutorial. We got to get around it being a tutorial so that you can go outside and you can, who cares? Just why is it a tutorial? Just make it not a tutorial.
I think I'm also going to go with a three. I feel like if this series goes for 250, 300 chapters, that the pacing of this section of it is fine. But taking it as it is on its own, the pacing of this part of it doesn't really satisfy me.
No, and there's, again, I don't know how much say the writer and artist have in this sort of thing, but like where the season ended made absolutely no sense.
Yeah.
The things they call finales are not finales. Right. So I'm a little concerned that they don't know where the interesting beats are happening. That could be a problem that compounds in the future. So yeah, you know, it's all subject to change. We say that every time too, is that when you're looking at part of a story, some things start slow and pick up, some things go really quick and slow down. I'm not going to say this is the forever score, but there's room for improvement.
Yeah.
Some, when you're good at everything, this is a problem a lot of isekais have. When the character's got to be good at everything and you got to establish that she's good at everything, and I eventually get sick of, okay, I got you. She's good. She's good at everything. I got it. But I like that she has to work. I'm not saying I don't want to see the training. I'm just saying I don't need to see her train in alchemy, cooking, tea, fighting, praying.
Yeah.
You could, I didn't need really probably tea if I were to make a cut, but
yeah. So as opposed to content and ideas where I think like for me to bump this up a level later on, it would have to do something really original and surprise me. With pacing and structure, I can see this getting a higher score later on somewhat easily. They just need to, it's going to have to go on for longer to make the time make sense. But I think that could easily, more easily be bumped up. So characters, this is, I think I'm going to be a bit more generous with the rest of these, more so because I like what's going on. So for characters, I'm going with a 4.
I also went with a 4.
Yeah. I think a lot of what they're doing with the characters, I think you said this while we were going through the story, but like a lot of it makes sense. The setup and payoff of what the characters are doing, what Eyelad is doing and influencing people, it all makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot of setup and payoff that like it works well.
There are characters that are just bad for no reason and they get taken out pretty quickly as like a comedic moment, almost an obligatory Otome Isekai moment. But then there's characters like the two friends of the male protagonist. There's characters like the count's son, who are bad, but not irredeemably so, and they have reasons for why they're acting the way they act. And for the count's son, you know, somebody finally told him to shut up, and he listened, and he found something to dedicate himself to. Then the two friends, like, they saw that the male protagonist is actually the strongest amongst them, and he does try to protect them. And though they're not friends, they do look out for him, and they'll do him a favor every now and then. And so, like, I like that Aylet is making people better just by giving them a chance. And I think that's good character writing. It's easy to get really one-dimensional in isekai. But I'd say most of these characters have at least two dimensions. And often more. I mean, that's a little bit of a joke, but I think and there's a lot of writing time dedicated to characters that I think a lot of Otome Isekai kind of ignore, like the dad, the mom, their relationship is cute. Agnes as like a coach trainer is pretty cool.
Yeah, I think she's one of the most interesting characters because she's got a dichotomy of like, yeah, saint and, you know, kind and smart and everything, but also a badass and like fighting with swords and using aura and like all that, you know, fun action stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of cool to see an Otome Isekai that has like a mentor, like sensei type character. So yeah, solid 4.
Definitely solid. So art competency, I'm going to go with a 4 on this one. This would be one where I would want to give it a 4.5.
I kind of agree.
They're not really doing anything that is like, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing I've ever. I mean, we covered Mother's Marriage, contract marriage, and like that is just like literally every frame is a painting. This doesn't reach that level, but it's so incredibly competent, consistent, and like well done that like if it had its own style, it would be a 5. Because the one place where it stays below a 5 is that it's doing the standard manhwa style. It's just doing it perfectly.
Yeah. No, that is pretty much exactly what I would have said. It looks really good.
Yeah.
I think I told you, I literally would hang in my apartment a poster of that guy. what did I take a screenshot of? It's the muscle guy.
There was two. So there was the introduction, yeah. And then there was the shot where he rescued the other miner.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah. There's one where he's just like, it's this big daddy bear man who's like, what a great day to make my muscles happy.
Yeah.
I would. That's like your home gym poster.
But I'll tell you what, Leo would love this manhwa.
I mean, when it's good, it's really good. There's a few panels here and there that are a little off, but like, that's totally forgivable because you can tell the artist is probably working on a time crunch sometimes.
Mm.
But you got to really look for that stuff. You've got to be looking with an eye to like, okay, what am I going to criticize when I go over the rubric? there's really no notes that I would give the artist. It's just, yeah, there's not a lot of room for style in this one, I guess. So right. they didn't get to show off, maybe.
Well, but. I sort of have to disagree with that a little bit, because for artistic flourish, I'm going to give it a 5.
I still went with a 4.
Okay.
I like the, it's cartoony, and I mean that in like the Bugs Bunny sense.
Right. But the thing is, they do a lot with the white space, which is never white space. They do a lot with the panel layout. They do a lot with the composition. They do a lot with color. They do a lot with the way that the gods interact with their like speech bubble window things. And like,
there's a surprising amount of UI design.
Yeah. there's so much going on that is not the drawings of the characters in the environment, you know, things that are going on like outside of the main panel that you're looking at, and the way that certain panels stretch across what would be considered multiple pages and like lead into things. I think they're just doing a really, really great job of going beyond, here's a picture of the story that I'm telling, you know?
Yeah. I think just based on what I've read in the past, the stuff I've given a 5, I don't think it rises to that level, but they are doing enough for a 4 for sure.
See, when I was, because I specifically went and looked from a flourish perspective, and as I was looking at the margins and everything, and I went, you know what? A lot of what they're doing here with like, you know, flower borders and the way things pop and things flow and everything, it reminded me a lot of what they do with the flourish in Mother's Contract Marriage.
Maybe I'll reevaluate. We'll definitely come back to this one because yeah. There's only 50 chapters. So I'll make a note and I will I will specifically look at the flourish the next time we come back.
But that was the thing that really stuck out to me, because like I said, while the art competency, I don't think rises to that level of every frame is a painting, I think the flourish goes above what they're doing with the literal character art, you know? So I as someone who doesn't really pay attention to that stuff, it really stuck out to me. So,
okay.
Well, here's the key. Personal preference. I'm going with a 5.
Yeah, I was kind of between a 4 and a 5. I think I'll go with a 5.
Nice.
Because I did not have a problem like ever getting the reading done or turning a page. Like this one goes pretty quick. I imagine I would have been so deeply frustrated with the hiatus.
So there was something interesting with this, and this is how I knew it was definitely a 5, because I had originally started reading this and I got really into it. And then I think it was like chapter 22 where the original place where I was reading it stopped for a while. And I hadn't read it for a while. And then I saw like a new release of it. And that release was at like chapter 40 something. And I was like, okay, you know, I'll mark this. I'm definitely going to come back to it. I really like this, but like 20 chapters is a lot. And generally speaking, I have to be really into something to sort of binge a whole lot at once. When this was the series that was decided on by our patrons, I started reading it again, and I read chapter 23 to 50, whatever, in like a day and a half. I just blew through it because I got back into it and I was like, I love all of this. I'm going to keep going with the, this is great.
For whatever it's worth, for anybody else who is also caught in this like storm right now, this kept me from playing Baldur's Gate for 3 hours. So,
so yeah, this is definitely up there for me on personal preference. You know, as much as I was like, oh, it's not all that original and everything, but like it hits all of the points for me. It's everything I love about isekais and everything I love about Otome Isekai manhwa, like all together. If they do a romance plot properly, this is going to be like all time for me. It'll be top 3, I would imagine. Recommendation strength. I think I'm going with a 4 on this.
Going with a 4 only because of all the meta humor. If you don't know like the isekai, the romance games, or if you don't have some knowledge of this, if you're just like, if I plucked one of my friends off the street who is not into any of this stuff, not even into like K-pop, and showed him this, I don't think they'd really know what was going on. Yeah. That's the only thing that says like it's a strong recommendation to most people is like, I feel like a 5 has to be both really solid and also really accessible.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I feel like most of the series that we're going to cover are never going to come to a 5 on recommendation strength, just because like so many of them, while being really good, are also very Otome Isekai heavy, and you sort of miss out on a lot of it if you're not a genre fan. And so it comes to the point where it's like, can't really recommend this to people who aren't Otome Isekai fans. So I think we need to make it very, very clear that when we give a 4 on recommendation strength for these, we're basically saying, if you read any other Otome Isekai, read this one.
Yeah. I think it might be interesting to reach out to the Discord and the subreddit and see, like, what do people think the starter Otome Isekai is?
Yeah, that's a good point.
That,
Like, I don't know what, that we've.
Because I mean, I'm coming at it from a point of A, you're kind of guiding it. Yeah. You've told me a lot about these things outside of it. I do read romance novels for the other podcast. I do have some familiarity with like mobile games and anime and at least those tropes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking very specifically of, I have friends who are women who are mostly like, for whatever reason, this is who I tend to think about when I want to recommend this. Very academic. They're like, I have friends who have their PhDs who I think partly because they have their PhDs, they're like the only people I know who like had 10 years where they just couldn't have time to do any of this stuff. Who like, I think they would like some of these, but I had to think of all the stuff I'd have to explain to them. And it's like, well, would they want to do it? And, so yeah, that's what I'm really looking for with a general audience. And maybe that's a recommendation people can give us is like, well,
I mean, all of our listeners, they should think about this. Jump on our Discord, give us a recommendation. You can send us an email, isekaisenseisama@gmail.com. Give us a recommendation, jump on the website, leave a comment to give us a recommendation. We want to know what the very best intro manhwa would be. Beginner level manhwa to say, you read this and you will then know about Otome Isekai manhwa.
Yeah.
And then you can read the rest of the ones that we're recommending.
Imagine you're talking to somebody who had like Sailor Moon. Like they watched anime back then, but then checked out for 10 years.
Right. Well, all right. That'll do it for our scores. So we just got to add these up now and let's see where we're at. Well, it looks like I ended up at 75 out of 100.
73 out of 100. The rubric works.
So I see out here on Bato, this series is rated at 9.3. So unfortunately, I'm going to bring that score down a little bit, but I'm giving it an 8.
Yeah, I'd say this is the difference that the rubric tries to balance between, did I like it? Yeah, I liked it 9 out of 10, for sure. Mm-hmm. Is it good? I think 8 out of 10 is more fair.
Yeah. Yeah, 8 out of 10, I think that's really good. I will say, they give you a little chart of like how many people gave it what amount. And it's a little confusing because they go off of 5 stars. So even though you're rating it 1 to 10, they break those down into, so I'm not sure how
ratings are such nonsense
all works, but yeah. It is at 84% 5 stars. So
yeah, it all depends what you do when you rate. I think it's totally fine to rate things just based on how much you personally like them.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what I like to do because that doesn't give you as much of a conversation about it. But yeah, that's ratings are nonsense. They're just good for recommendations. You should probably know who's rating it, know if you like what they like, and then, you know.
Right. So once again, you can go on the website now and check out the table that will give you our actual scores. And I'm going to spend a bunch of time over the next couple of weeks going back and listening to the old episodes and getting the scores out of those so I can update the old ones. Just should have been doing since we started the rubric. But that's also going to allow us to very easily go back and see which ones we didn't do the rubric for, because we're going to have to redo those at some point and give those a score. And then when we do a recap episode at some point, we'll be able to compare our scores easily.
Let us know which academic journal we can publish our findings in.
So that'll do it for the perks of being an S-class heroine. I'm having a really good time with it, so I'm looking forward to where that's going. But now it's time to pick the next series. So if you were paying attention, you'll know that we put a poll up on Patreon for our patrons to pick out of three choices which series we should cover next. Last month, I guess, our choices were between this, Perks of Being an S-Class Heroine, Becoming the Dark Hero's Daughter, and Beatrice. We did have one person vote for Beatrice. Apparently, there is some kind of controversy around that, which I didn't really get into. I didn't want to spoil that ahead of time.
Oh no!
But I really like Beatrice, so I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. I think some people were saying there's like some problematic stuff in there, but I was like,
In Otome Isekai? Yeah, no, right? No. Can't be.
So, Ben, I'm going to leave it up to you. If you want to just pick one and keep those other two choices, or if we should pick three completely new ones.
So, refresh my memory. Did the other two choices get votes?
Yeah, so Perks of Being an S-Class Heroine got the most. Beatrice got one vote. Nobody voted for Becoming the Dark Hero's Daughter.
Well, I'd say put Beatrice back up.
All right.
Give it another shot. And then, yeah, do I just get to pick two more?
Yeah, if we can pull up the list and
pick two more. Looking at the list. I'm going by title alone. I'm not even looking at the cover art. Okay, let me see. These are all kind of similar. The villainess is a marionette.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay.
That's so much drama. If we want to give it a little bit of a spread, I would recommend The Precious Daughter of the Greatest Martial Arts Villain, which is a lot of wuxia stuff.
There we go. Throw it on there.
All right. I know who's going to vote for that one.
I don't.
So just a reminder, that poll will go up. When I release this episode, it'll be up there for a week. And you can go on our Patreon and you gotta join. I hope the tiers are good enough now that people can join to vote on this. I got some feedback that the lowest tier was maybe a bit too high, so there's another tier that's lower than that now. So you can go on there. Every patron gets to vote on Heroin Addiction, but only the higher levels will get the episodes early. And you can also just let us know what kind of perks that you want. We're very early on with Patreon, so like we don't have a ton of different perks out there yet, but I'm more than willing to add more perks, so let us know what you want. So that'll do it for us today. Thanks so much for listening. We want to thank Sugoi Mart for partnering with us. Sugoi Mart is a retailer of Japanese snacks, drinks, toys, and merch. And they got a lot of cool stuff you can't get outside of Japan. You check the link in the description or use code APR15 at checkout to get 15% off your first order, which also helps us out. You can let us know what you think on social media and tell us if you have a series you want us to cover. Like I said, we're looking for a recommendation for the beginner manhwa. You can check out our website, animepodcastsofreincarnation.com, where you can leave comments on these podcast episodes and also find other posts and reviews. We've got a Discord where you can come chat with us, and check out our Patreon. Supporters get the perks. Like I said, you get to vote on which series we cover, as well as the high quality stereo version of the podcast. And we love to hear what perks you want. We got two patron shout outs. So we got Rainbow Jello. And Rainbow Jello, I know who you are. If you want me to use a different name, just let me know. And our second patron shout out, Rena. Our biggest fan, Rena, joined us on Patreon. We're very appreciative of that. And Rena, I hope you get to the poll in time and vote on which series you want us to cover. Be sure to check out the regular podcast, That Time I Got Reincarnated in the Same World as an Anime Podcaster. And we're actually starting a new series. Kermit and I are doing a new series called Shonen Jumping the Gun. And that will be on the off weeks. So we're going to be doing two of those a month. Those are going to be shorter, but we're covering the first chapter of new manga that's coming out. And probably in the future, we'll do like older ones that we haven't read, and we'll just read a chapter. And so that's going to be sort of like a, hey, this is a new thing, and where do we think it's going to go, and that kind of thing. So our first episode, we're covering Kagurabachi, which is a new manga in Shonen Jump, and it's getting memed like crazy, and we're not sure why.
Is memeing a bad thing? I'm old.
I mean, sometimes, a lot of times, stuff gets memed, and it's like, oh, it's because it's silly, and, you know, people are making fun of it. Honestly, it's not bad, so I'm not sure why the memeing is sort of going out of control.
Maybe it's just free attention.
And if you can't get enough about Ben reading things, make sure to check out his other podcast, Words About Books. Covering anything fun recently?
It's spooky month.
Oh yeah, Ben's Horror Bullshit Month.
By the time this comes out. And I think the first thing we're going to be doing, I wanted to focus on body horror this month.
Okay.
Free freaks out there. And we're doing The Hellbound Heart, which Hellraiser is based on. And then I think we're actually going to watch Hellraiser. Nice. It's a book podcast, and I've decided that counts.
Well, hopefully you thoroughly traumatize me.
I'm trying, but I think he actually liked it.
Well, once again, thanks for listening. We hope you had a good time. Now, I must go see a man about a manhwa. I wonder if there's a pronunciation for this. Let's see.
Is this a real name somewhere?
The Aliette was a component of 13th century knightly armor.
It says Aliette in the French pronunciation.
That makes me wonder, because her nickname that people use is A-I-L. So how are you supposed to pronounce that?
Ale. I don't know. I was telling one of my Indian friends this the other day. I was like, whenever I used to speak French, like I passed a college interview in French. I actually had a conversation, and Japanese is like somehow like overwritten it. Now, whenever I reach in my brain for a foreign language, it's a mixture of like my favorite Japanese word and my favorite French word. And yeah, so in Japanese you would pronounce that Aliette. But
how would you pronounce it in Korean? That's the real question.
I have no clue. Trying to think if there's anybody else.
And I guess Fenrir. Except
yeah, that's an easy
Heath one, Fenrir.
Heath Fenrir. So he's from the. I mean, so he's from the Heath. He's from the Wolf Heath. It is kind of weird that they're all French, but like he's Norse. But that's good old fashioned Korean. Europe's all Europe.
Does this world even have a north?
Just waiting for this guy to work out whatever is going on with his tummy. Yeah. So,
means I actually have to keep track of this and not just trash this document as soon as I'm done with it.
I always just load it into paint and draw red boxes around it. Yeah, I use paint. I'm a computer person.
Well, I'm just using Notepad++ because I'm a programmer.
Oh, yeah.
I hope people get that. Have you heard that? I've got to go see a man about a horse.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's what I thought you were referencing. I have an illicit business deal.
I was looking at it because it popped into my head of like, oh, what should I? And I looked it up, and apparently it's mostly used for people to say that they have to go to the bathroom, like in British parlance. But I did see like, yeah, it's used for lots of different things. So.
Oh, man.